You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Volume 14. Volume 14, Finn. Who would have thought it? And it's still going strong. Second year. And have you decided to go into archaeology, I believe?
We have. It's that time of year when colleagues are disappearing off to the archives, but in the case of the three colleagues with us today, they are disappearing off to somewhere outdoors, possibly, to dig things up. And
so what you're saying, Phil, is they're actually going to be digging holes in the ground?
Quite possibly.
Digging his hole in the ground, so big and sort of round it was, and there was I, digging it deep. It was flat at the bottom and the sides were steep. When along comes this bloke in a bowler, which he lifted and scratched his head. Whoa, he looked down the hole, poor demented soul, and he said, do you mind if I make a suggestion? Don't dig it there, dig it elsewhere. You're digging it round and it ought to be square. The shape of it's wrong, it's much too long, and you can't put a hole where a hole don't belong. I ask, what a liberty, eh? Nearly bashed him right in the bowler. Well, there was I, a sturdy me-o, shoveling earth for all that I was worth. I was, and there was him, standing up there so grand and official with his nose in the air. So I gave him a look sort of sideways and I leaned on me shovel and sighed. Whoa, I lit me a fag and having took a drag, I replied, I just couldn't bear to dig it elsewhere. I'm digging it round cause I don't want it square, and if you disagree it doesn't bother me. That's the place where the O's gonna be. Well, there we were discussing this hole in the ground, so big and sort of round it was, it's not there now. The ground's all flat and beneath it is the bloke in the bowler hat. And that's that.
The inimitable Bernard Cribbins with Hole in the Ground. And so I'm joined today by three colleagues going down from as far away from me and back down the line, Dr. Lacey Wallace, Dr. Kat Fennelly, and Dr. Mark Gardner, all of whom work on, are archaeologists, but working on quite different periods. And I thought it might be interesting, first of all, to ask you all how you came to get involved in archaeology to begin with. Who'd like to start?
I can't remember when I was not involved in archaeology. I was, as a child, I used to wander across the South Downs and look at archaeological sites, and then I became interested in abandoned canals, and then I had a fascination with telegraph stations and rode across Sussex and Surrey and Hampshire looking for abandoned Napoleonic telegraph stations, optical telegraph stations, and it led on from there.
Can you remember, I'd come to the other two in a minute, can you remember a particular trigger that set this off to begin with?
My primary school was on the opposite side of the valley, but immediately overlooked Cissbury Ring in the South Downs. And Cissbury Ring is this marvellous Iron Age hill fort, and you could not ignore it. You couldn't pretend it wasn't there. It was just sitting there on the skyline, and it was always a sort of a presence, and it obviously affected me.
Kat?
I guess I was actually always interested in history. My dad is a big history buff, and he's the type of history buff who collects things as well. So there was always kind of bits of old 18th century, 19th century agricultural equipment lying around our garden that my mother hated but my dad loved. So I always kind of equated, I suppose, history with stuff, but it was always history, and I was really into medieval history. Sort of digressing away from history, though, I mean, the way I felt about The Lord of the Rings was the way my friends felt about music. And I really, really wanted to kind of study medieval history and do that. So I went to university to do that, and then I went on fieldwork and became utterly indoctrinated by archaeology. It was just digging. Digging was the thing that got me into it. I never really considered myself kind of an exercisey, outdoory person, but being out there with a shovel in the ground, kind of suddenly this was something that I didn't have to think about being good at. I was actually okay at it from the start. And it just sort of snowballed from there. I moved well away from medieval history and started looking at 19th century asylum buildings, which I suppose was a bit of a leap, but that was...
So where were you digging the first? Do you remember the first place you were digging?
I do. I was a student, so it was the UCD Field School at Temple Teignmouth in County Wicklow. It was a medieval pilgrimage site, so it was on the pilgrim route from Clonmacnoise to Glendalough, two major monastic sites in Ireland. So medieval, but the site that we were digging seemed to have quite a lot of kind of 19th century disturbance on it as well. And this was my first introduction to 18th and 19th century archaeology, because some of the stuff that we were digging up was people recutting or taking stones away in the 19th century to use in their houses. And there was also kind of several burials sort of dotted around the place as well. So, I mean, it was very much kind of a mixed site. And my second site then was supposed to be a Minoan site in Crete. And actually, I just became really interested in digging the Venetian church up the hill. I was more into that. I was, again, kind of 14th century.
Not a bad place to go and have to dig, I imagine.
It was very nice, yeah.
Lacey?
Well, it's funny. Despite having several opportunities thrust upon me to be interested in archaeology when I was a kid, it never really clicked what archaeology was. I think I didn't even know what it was, really, until university. Because I grew up north of Boston, where the Central Artery Project was happening when I was young. And my Girl Scout troop was actually taken to see an excavation and shown some objects. And I remember being quite bored and not interested. And then later, my brother and I used to dig up old glass bottles from some dairy farm that was on our land when I was a kid. Again, just never occurred to me that that had any relationship to, you know, Indiana Jones or the Goonies or anything that might have gotten me into archaeology. Really, I was interested in historic architecture, mostly because I like to imagine the spaces where Jane Austen and, you know, Charlotte and Emily Bronte were setting their stories. And I remember having an extremely romantic teenager wander on the moors when I was about 16. And that probably prepped something in my head, but I actually went to university to do fine art. And I discovered that painting and drawing and sculpture weren't really my passion. And I had one free class I was allowed to take, and basically I was handed the prospectus, and they said, pick something. And because I was already taking art history, and the code for art history was AH, and that was in the beginning of the book, I skipped the art history section, knowing that I was already doing some of that. And the next section was archaeology. And I didn't want to take the intro classes because they seemed big and boring. And classical archaeology, although it was a second-year course, was open to first-year students. And I really just selected it almost at random. I'd read Courtesans and Fish Cakes, but again, had no concept. This is a famous book about Greek history. But really had no concept of when kind of 500 BC was. I didn't really do that kind of history when I was younger. And basically that course was just an absolute revelation. I switched archaeology. I scheduled my first fieldwork for that summer and never looked back.
So do you remember the first place you were digging?
Yes, of course. It was a site called Talati de Dalt on Menorca, which is one of the Balearic Islands.
Sunny places. I've obviously been in the wrong job.
We all did end up doing archaeology in Britain and Ireland, so we didn't stick with it, did we? It was beautiful. It was a prehistoric site that also had some later stratigraphy from, I think, through the Roman period.
Stratigraphy?
And layers of occupation built up over time.
Will you search through the lonely earth for me? Climb through the briar and bramble. I'll be your treasure. I felt the touch of the kings and the breath of the wind I sang ye the call of all the songbirds. They sang all the wrong words. I'm waiting for you. I'm waiting for you. Swim through the briny sea for me, crawl along the ocean's floor. I'll be your treasure. I'm with the ghosts of the men who can never sing again. There's a place, follow me, where a love lost at sea is waiting for you, is waiting for you.
The theme to The Detectorists, about which I confess I'm ignorant, so I might quiz some of you about that later on. But before we get to perhaps into the more sort of popular culture side of archaeology, which you might think a bit about later, so we've sort of got you onto these sites and digging away, and I'd be interested to explore a bit more what the processes are of archaeology. Presumably there's a range of tools and sort of rules by which you have to go about digging these holes. I mean, not obviously quite like the man in the bowler hat turning up and lecturing Bernard Cribbins, but perhaps be interesting to hear a little bit about that. Who would like to...
I will start with not digging holes, because that's what I'm currently doing at the moment. Essentially, we all start with a question of some kind, an interest, and we have some kind of agenda for trying to answer our questions. Archaeology is inherently destructive, and it's probably one of the only sciences or social sciences that sort of destroys the evidence as it's collected, and it's kind of destruction that's justified by quite careful recording. And, we're extremely good at that nowadays, but in the early days of archaeology, they weren't so much. It was more dig a big hole and keep what you find in it. But the type of work that I've been doing mostly is actually non-destructive, non-intrusive, which is geophysical survey, which most people know from Time Team. And in that case, we define an area of interest somehow, and for my fieldwork in Kent, it's mostly through aerial photograph analysis. And so we might see a crop mark of a feature show up in an aerial photograph and think that because of the morphology of the feature and where it's located in relation to natural topography or springs or rivers or hills or that kind of thing, that it might have some relationship to the questions that I'm asking. And then we'll go down and walk around in straight lines with machines that go beep. And then it's mostly computer analysis, computer mapping, and modeling later on. But you don't have that thrill of, finding something during the day. But at the end of the day, in the pub, when we show everyone the data, it can be quite exciting.
What are they detecting when they go beep?
Well, what I mostly use, because it's fast and covers a large area, is generally called magnetometry, which is really magnetic radiometry. And the machines are called fluxgate radiometers, and they measure tiny, tiny differences in the magnetic field, measured in nanotesla, tiny, tiny differences. And so, 5-10 nanotesla are the kind of difference you might expect from a buried wall or a buried ditch. And because they're so sensitive, they can pick that up. And then also very strong signals are produced by burning or anything metallic, anything that's been heated to the Curie point as well. So brick will show up as extremely strong signals. So,
Thank you.
Well, shall I talk a little bit about fieldwork following on from Lacey?
Yes.
Because Lacey's looking at the surface, and I'm also looking at the surface, but I'm looking at that. I spend a lot of my time wandering around fields, looking at humps and bumps in the ground and trying to make sense of them. And the point about them is, once one gets one's eye in, is one can first of all tell what is natural and what's not, and then you begin to work out the reasons that these lumps and bumps have been made. And they may have been made because there was a building there. It may have been made because agriculture was practiced there. It may be because someone's created a bank and a ditch to keep animals in. And after a while, you begin to work out the rules of the game, because I think the general principle is that there's a rationality, there's an order. People don't go to the effort of piling up soil or digging ditches or whatever it is in a sort of totally random way. They're doing it because they're creating something. And I suppose the surprising thing is that, you know, they may have done this 500, 1,000, 2,000 years ago, and there are the lumps and bumps. Of course, they've sort of slumped a little bit, but essentially what people did, what they created, the buildings they built, you know, may have collapsed, but there is still a sort of lump left as a result of that collapse. And by looking at the surface of the ground, if it hasn't been ploughed flat, you can actually sort of pick up what's going on. You can often work out a sequence, you can work out what sort of activities, and sometimes you can even tell the date, because certain features are produced at a certain period, and you can work out what's going on. So actually, the land, and it's all set in a landscape, so it actually speaks very clearly about the activities which have gone on. And just as we've talked about magnetic survey, you know, in the same sort of way, looking at earthworks tells us about the way things have, what has happened.
So you're getting to a situation, I'll come to Captain Amir, you're getting to a situation where, in a sense, you're reading the landscape in a sort of completely different way to how a non-archaeologist would read it, just by looking at it. You know, where I'm just seeing, say, I don't know, hills and streams and whatever, you know, you're seeing a sort of sense of what it might have looked like hundreds of years ago.
I think I don't go through the landscape and see what is there. I immediately go and see what was there. And I find it very difficult to go out for a walk and not see archaeological things and try and interpret it. And I find it actually deeply disconcerting to go through a landscape and not understand the processes, the human processes, which have led to the creation of that landscape. Because most landscapes are the product of many thousand years of human activity. And that's, and understanding that to me is everything about what being in the countryside is.
Well, I suppose, I mean, I'm a 19th century archaeologist, excuse me, so I guess I differ from these guys in that most of my stuff actually isn't in the ground. Archaeology is such a huge, vast discipline chronologically. I mean, we cover from deep time up until the present day. There's even some interesting archaeologies of things like the future and kind of the virtual world. So, I mean, my archaeology is not, most of it's not in the ground, most of it's still standing. I look at standing buildings, and I look at the way they're kind of put together. One of the best kind of definitions of archaeology that I've ever read is from the late 1970s. It's quite a very structured view of it, but it's that archaeology is about the intersection between material culture and human behaviour, and it doesn't have to be in the ground, and we don't have to dig for it to see it, so that we can look at a room even like this one, or we can look at a building like this, and we can view it archaeologically, that archaeology is a way of seeing something. So what you were saying, Finn, about kind of, is it different to the way you view the landscape? I mean, I do agree with Mark. It is hard to go out into the English countryside, for instance, and not see massive change over time. Not to see what some people would see as a big rural landscape as being the product of an almost kind of industrial farming or something like that. I guess one of the things that I'm always trying to get across with my work is that I am an archaeologist, I'm a committed archaeologist, and I do dig, but my research is not digging. But that doesn't make me less of an archaeologist. It just means that what I do is I go out, I photograph buildings, I look at maps and plans, and I go into the archive just like you. I do kind of a lot of interdisciplinary research where I kind of pile up maps on top of each other. But I guess kind of it is really important just to get that message across, that archaeology is not just digging holes in the ground and that kind of destructive way of looking at it. It's also about, there's a huge method that goes with it, and we all approach it differently.
Is there a tension in the discipline then between, as it were, between, in, I suppose, between invasive and non-invasive, or between diggers and people like yourself or who are working more on plans? Because I sort of felt there was sort of perhaps a hint of that in what you were saying, but perhaps not so much.
This is something that I have come across in later historical archaeology because I work on the 18th and 19th century. A lot of what I do is very established in North America. It's very established kind of in Australia as well. And they do have 18th, 19th century archaeology in the ground. So their approach to that material is very different to my approach, which is standing buildings. I wouldn't say there's so much of a tension anymore, but sometimes there is a conversation about whether or not what someone does can be considered archaeology or anthropology or material history. But I don't know about these guys, if they find it in their work.
Well, I find that with remote sensing, there's often, you present your work and then people might say, other archaeologists might say, have you ground truthed that? Some ground truthing would be good, which is, going and digging a few holes to check the dates of things and make sure that they are what you think they are, because we're just interpreting sort of two-dimensional images or three-dimensional models that are made from topographical survey or from the detection. The thing is, well, truth is a problematic word, obviously. Again, Indiana Jones has settled for us. We don't need to get into that too much. But I think that, all archaeology is interpretation. There is no evidence that speaks for itself. And so everything really is complementary. The data can be created in layers, and as long as you understand the limitations of each and sort of the granularity or the resolution that you get from different types of data, that they all can certainly work together. And you can't answer every single question with simply one method anyway.
Can I pick up on the question which underlies your question, which is archaeology about digging? Because I think we would all agree that actually digging is the last resort, it's not the first resort. And people think that archaeology is about excavating. Well, most archaeologists only excavate because it's so expensive, it's so time consuming, it takes a long time to sort out the results. We only excavate really when we're absolutely clear that there's no other way of answering the question, because almost every other way is quicker and will produce results more rapidly.
Yes, and presumably you've got greater freedom where, you're more likely to get permission, say, on private land to walk around it with machines that go beep than you are to take the bulldozers and start, or whatever, more refined methods we
definitely
have now.
Definitely no bulldozers involved, yeah. Well, that's one of the great things about working in Britain is the private property law, and that you can simply get permission from somebody to go work on their land, and if they agree, then you can do it as long as it's not a scheduled monument. But even in that case, you can get consent for a survey, especially for non-intrusive methods around scheduled monuments. In other countries, in Greece, you have to buy the land and then donate it to the state. In Italy, everything underneath the ground belongs technically to the state, that kind of thing. So we are really quite lucky. I have been doing mostly rural settlement lately, and of course, when there's an agricultural concern, then there are certain reasons you can't go on a field at certain times, or they don't want to, the farmer or the tenant, the owner, doesn't want to disrupt the crop, and so that might be problematic. But basically it's private land is.
Time your watch back about 100,000 years.
B-52s with Mesopotamia. So you were saying at one point in the last segment about the way that there's been a kind of shift from the idea of just digging big holes in the ground to, I suppose, putting it at its simplest, to walking around in a field with machines that go bleep, I've rather fallen in love with this whole concept. But I was wondering to what extent, sort of, what you think led to that happening. Was it just that new technologies became available that meant that the process of archaeology could be done in a different way? Or was it that there was a sort of wholesale kind of questioning of methods because of the consequences of a more invasive approach? Or a combination of the two?
I think it was a result of observation that these early antiquarian archaeologists dug extremely quickly, and over the years people started noticing that there were layers. You know, we said stratigraphy earlier, but there was layers to the dirt in the same way that there's layers to geology. And as geology was developing as a discipline, archaeology started to sort of borrow some of the ideas. And then in the early 20th century, there was some major pioneering archaeologists, Mortimer Wheeler and Kathleen Kenyon and whatnot, who developed these new strategies and methods for sort of recording this layer-by-layer approach. And then as science progressed in other fields, archaeology sort of borrowed what it could. It's very much a parasitic discipline and is usually a bit behind the times in terms of the technology. You know, we'll be very excited about a particular tool or piece of equipment that actually has been around for about 15 years. It's hardly ever, you know, really cutting edge or really developing technology, but rather borrowing it. And but it's been, it's been good to keep up with the social sciences, with the hard sciences, and to sort of make use of what it can.
So, sorry, did you want to come in?
Yeah, I would say as well that some of the kind of the popularity of things like remote sensing also coincides with an increasing kind of professionalization of the discipline. I mean, not immediately after the war, but in the kind of 1970s, 1980s, as archaeology began to be kind of legislated for, as it became part of the planning process. As Mark mentioned earlier, I mean, excavation is expensive. So looking for kind of ways around identifying exactly where to dig if digging is necessary on things like greenfield sites or even on brownfield sites, remote sensing just became more and more useful because it's not just us who are archaeologists working in universities. Most of the archaeologists actually working are commercial archaeologists who work for commercial units.
I think the other real factor which changed in archaeology was a realization that we weren't dealing any longer with archaeological sites. We thought that, you know, the world was made up of discrete sites which you could put fences around and protect. And suddenly we realized actually that the whole landscape everywhere was an archaeological site. And we moved away from the idea of sites to the idea of the historic environment. And once you begin to realize that people don't just live in small places, but of course they cultivated, they managed the land, they did it everywhere, and there is traces of it everywhere, then you have to work out a sort of totally different way of looking at the landscape and working out how to deal with the study of the past, because you can't just sort of isolate your study to sort of houses. It's the broader area that you're interested in. So Lacey's talked about geophysical survey, and the point about geophysical survey is that it covers very large areas and it can pick up ditches and sorts of things, not just the houses. So this has been the real change in thought, and that was very much emerging out of aerial photography, but then sort of going on and people discovering in the 60s that there were hundreds of sites. There weren't just a few sites, there were hundreds of sites, and then using aerial photography to discover whole landscapes.
There's a quote by a very inspirational, energetic archaeologist called Dominic Pausland, which I'm going to butcher at the moment because I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was something like archaeologists would do better to, instead of standing on the side of the trench looking in their interpretation, to stand inside the trench and look out. And I think that sort of sums up this shift of thinking beyond the concept of your trench, your site, your building.
So is there a kind of democratization of the discipline happening alongside as well? I don't know whether you're moving from, because I was suddenly starting to think, well, you were all talking about
looking back into the 19th century in a kind of, I suppose, the idea of a sort of more elite period of sort of lordly figures going to in search of the, I don't know, in search of the site of Troy or whatever, and to this more, obviously more professional approach.
But there's an interesting relationship between the Napoleonic Wars and the British sort of elite not being able to holiday on the continent and do their grand tour and go look at Pompeii and whatever. And so they decided to stay home and dig up the ancient monuments on their land here. And certainly that was, you know, part of the beginnings of antiquarianism. And the if you look at the membership of the Society of Antiquaries of London, these were not merchants and traders. Later on, Charles Roach Smith and some others in the sort of Victorian period were more, I guess, middle class. There was definitely a trend in the direction of it not just being these great landowners. But it was after the war, I think, when more people started going to university and archaeology departments started to be created. And as Kat said, archaeology, the fear of the destruction of heritage through the massive building booms sort of spurred more archaeological discoveries.
Yeah, one of the kind of major discoveries that really pushed archaeology into the public eye and made it more of a public concern was the discovery of the Temple of Mithras in the 1950s in the city of London. This was kind of, you know, it's not the first archaeological site to be found in the UK, but it's right in the middle of the city. It's very visible to everyone around, and it's also visibly kind of... you can draw a parallel between what's going on in London and what's going on in Rome. So archaeology stops being something that is happening in Greece and in Rome and happening to rich people and starts becoming something that's kind of ours or parts of the city in a very real way. Moving on then, kind of, there's various high-profile discoveries, the biggest one being, I suppose, the Rose Theatre in the 1980s, just drew so much attention from, you know, major actors. There's loads of incredible photographs of people like... Ian McKellen and Ray Fiennes standing on the side of the trench around the Rose Theatre and really drawing attention to what archaeologists are doing, professional archaeologists are doing, and the imperative of digging or the imperative of kind of rescue archaeology in the planning process. And that really kind of drew archaeology into the public eye. There has been some argument that the kind of the creation of archaeology as being something that is a planning imperative has actually created a gulf between academics and commercial archaeologists. And then there's also the sort of the third group, which is the public, who are also kind of involved in archaeology as well. And this is kind of, I suppose, where we are in the last 10 years, that there is this increasingly kind of closing interface between commercial archaeologists and academic archaeologists. And the public seems to be kind of the way of communicating that. I don't know how these guys feel about it.
Well, I would just say there's, you know, those two groups, commercial, public, there's also museums, and there's amateur archaeologists and community archaeologists and, you know, all kinds of different archaeologists. And, of course, some of my favorite people in the world are metal detectorists. And I work with them as much as I possibly can because they have a different way of researching the past and a different relationship to archaeology and different values and goals from the kind of work they do. And, you know, when we all work together, it is, it makes it much more interesting. And it's nice to think they can get involved.
Perhaps I can just tell you a bit about from my own experience about the sort of public involvement. And I was, I first did my very first large excavation in 1985, and I was digging a friary site in the middle of Lewes in Sussex. And it was the time when archaeology was done very largely with what are called volunteers. And they were volunteers. They were people who had never dug before, never, but had an interest in it. And we excavated this huge urban site. We had 30 or 40 people every day working on the site, and vast public interest because the people could see this site emerging from the ground. You know, we were taking the soil off, and there the walls were appearing. It was extremely dramatic. And, I mean, it was, for me, it was quite frightening because there was me and one other person. We were the only people who'd ever dug before and were professional archaeologists. But we gradually trained people up. We got some very skillful people who picked up the skills very rapidly, and we excavated with it over a period of 6 weeks this really large medieval site. It was terrifically hard work, but there was marvellous public involvement, so much so that at one point the local newspaper appeared with the mayor making an appeal that this site should be preserved. Well, it was practically impossible to preserve the site. It was 2 metres down below street level. But it showed the sort of strength of feeling that had emerged out of this sort of campaign of work. So it was very much a sort of, you know, professional public cooperation, and that worked very well.
The relationship to people's identities in the modern day and how they consider the local heritage and local archaeological sites to be part of their modern communities is quite interesting. What Kat was saying about the Temple of Mithras in London, I can't remember what the number is, but there's a Daily Mail headline that says something. It's a phenomenally high number, like 30,000 people queued for miles to see the Temple of Mithras, because that sort of post-war blitz spirit, I guess, was bringing people together to say this is our city and this is our history and we don't want it destroyed. And it was the passion of the people that brought, I believe it was some kind of question in Parliament that gave W.F. Grimes of the Museum of London? It was not the Museum of London at the
Guildhall
time.
Museum.
The Guildhall Museum, yeah. Yeah, the permissions to continue and take extra time and disrupt construction because it was that important to the people.
Once I was a famous archaeologist named during a recent expedition in a distant land. I just happened to be passing my hand in the sand, and then I stopped, looked, and then I was hooked. I saw a flash, then a sparkle from a moonstone, and the mist started to clear. I saw a face in the moonstone, and it started to disappear. Well, I walked and never talked for many days. And without a friend, the desert is a lonely place. I was just about to turn around and make way home when something told me that I had to see it again. And then I stopped, looked, and then I was hooked. I saw a flash, then a sparkle from a moonstone, and the mist started to clear. I saw a face in the moonstone, and it started to disappear. Avure, avure, avure. And then it started to disappear. And then it started to disappear.
Moonstone from Cat Stevens. So one of the things that was coming up in the last segment was this distinction between professional, they're both professional, let me rephrase that, between research and academic archaeologists and commercial archaeologists. I was wondering how do commercial archaeologists make the job pay?
I just want to say...
obviously not professional, yes.
We really should say something like threat-driven or development-driven archaeology, because of course many, many of them work for trusts and
yes,
charitable
sorry,
trusts.
Yes, sorry, yeah, that was
museums. It's not
absolutely,
commercial.
Absolutely,
yeah, yeah,
yeah. Thank you.
Sorry, go on.
No. So in fact, commercial is actually a poor kind of term in that case, because because what I was sort of thinking about, it implies one side have got to make this pay in a certain way, whereas presumably academia doesn't have to do so.
I mean, no archaeology pays, that's for sure. Development-driven archaeology, there are certainly private contract organizations, and they do manage to pay their staff, not well at all. There are some kind of, not really lobbying, but there are some sort of groups that try to set standards for pay, but much of it, you know, at the bottom end of the excavator scale, and these are people with bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, just out of their PhD, looking for their first archaeological job sometimes. And sometimes there are people who have been doing it for years and, you know, are really quite skilled archaeologists, may only be able to get a three-month contract here and then have to move across the country and do another 3 months there, working extremely long days, traveling to and from site, working in the rain, 12 months out of the year, that sort of thing. So, yes, they certainly are getting paid to do archaeology. It's definitely out of the love for the discipline, though, because it's a bit bit arduous, really.
I think there is a contrast between, on the one hand, you know, commercially driven archaeology and research archaeology, and the commercially driven archaeology, obviously it's driven by the sites that are being excavated are the sites which are in the way of a road, they're in the line of a railway track, or they're under a building which is going to be redeveloped. And the archaeology is there because not all archaeology can be preserved, because it's almost ubiquitous, so it's recorded. That's one form of archaeology. We have the luxury, on the other hand, of being able to say, well, look, we have a certain problem. Where are we going to go and work to solve that sort of problem? So we have the luxury to pick and choose. On the other hand, we often don't have the same resources which the commercially funded archaeologists have. So there is a separation, but it's not entirely, you know, it's not like two different worlds. And often there's a huge amount of work or the results of the work which comes out of commercially funded archaeology, which of course is informing, you know, the work which goes on at universities, the interpretation which we have. So it's not two separate worlds. There's a lot of interaction, and sometimes the commercial work is informed by, often it's informed by research work, and vice versa. It's an interesting relationship.
Yeah, I think the difficulty is that we need to make sure to talk to each other more and to try to work together a bit more, which is very difficult because the demands of our, you know, day jobs are so very different. And in development-driven archaeology, they have to account for their time by project. And so they, you know, having something that sort of stretches out into a long research project can be quite difficult for them to just figure out how to workload that, basically. But there have been some really fantastic things, some fantastic collaborations. The Rural Settlement of Roman Britain project, which is headed by Mike Fulford at the University of Reading, for example, was working with Cotswold Archaeology, and they have produced this absolutely phenomenal database and a couple of volumes about rural Roman archaeology. And, you know, one of the things that they point out is that it's something like 90% of the sites found since Planning Policy Guidance 16 was issued in 1990 have been found through development, not through research.
There have been some really positive moves recently as well. The kind of, as Lacey mentioned, there are several lobbying groups. I mean, really, probably the major positive move in the last couple of years is that the Institute for Field Archaeology has become chartered. So that should hopefully give voice to kind of, an incredibly, overeducated and underpaid group of people as development-led archaeologists. And there's also been some really positive collaborations with local councils. Things like the research frameworks that have been launched in the last few years are drawing attention to research that is important to councils. It's important to it's important for development-led archaeology, and it's now coming to the attention of academics through things like that.
I think there's also another issue, and that is when, if I'm, as a research archaeologist, excavating a site that's not going to be destroyed, I have an obligation to take it very carefully and do it in the best possible way, because that site is not going to be destroyed. It will be there in 100 years' time if I don't touch it. So that's not the case for other people. There's a road going through. That road is going to go through. The site will be destroyed, absolutely. And so
it's much more justifiable.
It is much more justifiable. So there is, you know, different responsibilities on different groups.
So I thought it might be interesting as we're moving towards the end of the show, which has rushed away rapidly as usual, to ask us, but we played obviously the Detectorists earlier. We just had another reference, musical reference to a famous archaeologist, possibly the most famous archaeologist of all in sort of popular culture at any rate. And I wonder, to what extent do you think the kind of representation of the discipline, the representation of the practitioners of it in those kind of popular ways, does it give a good reflection of what you folk are doing, or is it quite problematic?
Well, for me, it's very much based on the materials. The popular representation is about the objects, sort of museum-based study, which were the discovery of things that would go in museums, I suppose. Whereas in reality, it's not so much that we're fascinated by objects, and that's why we study the past. It's because we're fascinated by people and their engagement with the material world. And so we study people through material remains for the most part. And I think maybe besides dinosaurs, that's probably the biggest misconception, is that it's shiny things.
It certainly brings people to archaeology. Having been at archaeology open days and talked to students who are about to start archaeology programs, they know that it's not what archaeology is, but they definitely say Indiana Jones is my favourite film. And it's definitely a shorthand that you can use in undergraduate teaching when you put a picture of Indy with his bag of sand replacing the idol. So it opens up a conversation. It brings us to the public eye, which is not really that bad a thing, I think. But Mark might disagree with me.
No, I do agree. I think it was very useful in raising the profile of archaeology. But I think going on from there, I mean, Time Team was very important because it was a very widely watched television programme. And it revealed, I think, rather more clearly the processes of archaeology, and the whole idea of geophysics, which Lacey's talked about, became a sort of understood concept, which in the way that it never was before, and the whole processes became demystified. And I think it excited people. I mean, it led to a huge rise in, for example, university applications to do archaeology, and I think a sort of much greater understanding and enthusiasm to support the subject.
Is there a story you would like to see told in a kind of more popular framework, or an aspect of the discipline that you think is just crying out to be done as a film or an ongoing TV series?
So only criticisms come to mind, I'm sorry. The strange upland Wales landscape of Kent in the show Britannia is particularly galling. Guys?
I think that there are so many stories. Actually, archaeology is basically a thoroughly exciting subject, and the day that I wake up and I'm not excited about archaeology will be a sad day. It's full of revelations, it's full of excitements, and sort of going up, I worked in the uplands of Northern Ireland and discovering there, going up, I can remember going up onto the top and suddenly seeing an archaeological landscape. I mean, these were fantastic, and this kept me going for years looking at this.
The guys are right. I mean, there are so many stories. There's some really great stories about kind of people who are not archaeologists trying to do archaeology, that have also been told. I'd like to see an awful lot more. I remember there was that movie a couple of years ago, The Monuments Men, which I thought was going to be like the Mortimer Wheeler story, or something like that, and it kind of wasn't. And I'd like to see an awful lot more about some of the rescue archaeology that was done during the Second World War. It would be interesting to see a popular representation of that, because it is a really interesting story about kind of how we started to, as a discipline, think about recording sites very quickly, for instance.
There's a tension between narrative and sort of daily life and looking at the individual that I think could certainly be put to a sort of film adaptation quite successfully.
So we're careering towards the end of the show. I thought there was a final question I was going to ask you. So where are you going to be this summer, either digging or not digging?
I am tragically not doing field work for the first time in 18 years, because we have a duty to study our results and to publish them, which is what I really need to do.
I'm digging a Victorian bandstand in Sheffield this week. It's a community project, so we're inviting as many people to come as possible. It's one of those projects that we we know what we're going to be looking for. It's an interesting site. We're just going to be asking some interesting questions about kind of why bandstands in particular, why certain features are put in parks, how they bring pleasure to public. That's that kind of thing.
Well, like Lacey, I'm not digging this summer, and for the same reasons that I'm drawing together the results. We've had a marvellous project which has involved us going to Norway and Shetland and Iceland and Greenland and the Faroe Islands, and now's the time where we've got to stop and draw all these strands together. So that's my job over the summer and the coming year.
We'll be telling our stories.
We will.
So, for once, it really isn't going to be a summer about digging for most of my colleagues. Well, we have careered to the end of another past prologue. I'd like to thank, as always, my guests, Dr. Lacey Wallace, Dr. Kat Fenley, and Dr. Mark Gardner. I hope you all feel inspired to go out there and dig, or see if you can persuade someone to give you a machine that beeps and wander around some Kentish fields. Thanks also, as always, to Alex Lefchuk, my producer. And we will be back in around a month's time.
Feel the pain, feel the joy.